Hi there, everybody. My name is Laura Kellen-May from ThistleRidgeStables.com and Equestrian Skill Builders on Facebook.
Well, welcome, everybody. I'd like to welcome our guest, Susan Gordon from Salt Spring Islands. And Susan, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Laura. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me today.
Now, Susan, could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Well, yes. I call myself retired as a trainer, but I still have a client that I ride for. I'm also a photographer, an artist, and an author. But my love was horses, and hunter-jumper training was my previous career.
So was your hunter-jumper career on the Salt Spring Island, or was that somewhere else?
I actually started in Calgary. From Calgary, we moved back to British Columbia, ran a couple of barns here, and then finally Arizona. I worked for a trainer there. Actually, I was trying to stay out of the horse business. I kept getting back into it. So I built the bulk of my career in BC and really hadn't intended to get into horses in the South, but I just kept getting pulled back. So I just went with it.
So how did you get started with the product or book that you were going to be talking about today?
Well, the Compassionate Equestrian came about after my several decades, and I count the time that I was a teenager because I was just so interested in training horses. I actually got my first training project, two-year-old filly, when I was 14. I just love the idea of training animals. I always had an affinity for them, fascinated by bond that we could have. So it goes back to my childhood.
Now, how did all of these experiences that you have help you form the Compassionate Equestrian?
Well, Mrs. Souther, I mean, such an influence, really taught me about ethics in business, taking care of people at the barn. She may not even realize that she had that kind of effect on me, but she certainly did. There was just such an elegance and a grace about her. And then my instructor, who also taught me how to judge horses, she was not a Spruce Meadows-based instructor, but I was friends with her son. We went to the same high school. She was very close to Spruce Meadows. That was Margaret Ellard, who was a senior hunter-jumper, dressage judge, and a technical delegate. She also taught the real classical traditional training, and she was very interested in the fact that I wanted to be a trainer. So she just went the extra mile for me, as did Margaret Southern. They kind of instilled very high standards that I tried to hang on to throughout my career as a professional. Sometimes so many things happened and so many people just came along that just didn't have that kind of awareness or the time to spend with their horses. And, you know, as we went through the decades and technology took over and people got distracted and horses weren't being bred or trained for soundness. And after a while, I burnt out and quit a couple of times, actually. Those two women that really I've just kind of always tried to keep what I was taught in my heart, instill that in my students, and try to keep my horses sound and try to work for other trainers who might put pressure on me to do things that I wouldn't have done otherwise. Yeah, all of those experiences kind of led up to that. Plus my own spiritual practice. I had a very strong spiritual practice and influence in meditation. So it just kind of all came together a few years ago as I was looking for a different way to apply myself to the horse industry.
What do you think the number one thing holding people back from doing what they want to do? It sounds like you have followed your path to become a professional trainer and judging, and you had the support of some fantastic people.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think the number one thing holding people back from doing what they want to do?
You know, a lot of people are not like those two women. They limit people based on their own experiences. So they tell you, oh, you shouldn't do that. You can't do that. That's out of your league. You don't have qualifications to do that. And you hear these loops. And because our default mechanism is to always look for the negative, it's like, wow, I'm doing so great, but there must be something that's going to take that away from me. And you start to think with less confidence, or you start to second guess yourself instead of listening to your heart and knowing that this is really what you want to do. And yes, you are okay. You can do this, whether you need more training or different people. So you have to be very careful who you listen to. And you want to keep the toxic people, you know, at least at arm's length, if you can't remove yourself from them altogether. You know, I've watched instructors who teach by insult, is, I guess, the best way to put it in a nutshell. To keep people in good self-esteem, you have to inspire them.
Well, I think I understand what you mean by instructors teaching by insults. I've heard a few of those myself,
I'm sure.
Probably been on the receiving end a few of those myself as well. And
yeah.
And as an instructor, as you say, I try to be inspiring and lift people up to their higher levels. And I like where you say that listening to other people who only can only see to the end of their nose, they don't see what's beyond that, and their limiting beliefs and putting their limiting beliefs onto you. You have to kind of get away from that, right? You can't. Mm-hmm. Listen to other people. You have to, if you believe in yourself and have the confidence in yourself, then you have to keep going ahead, even find people who will mentor you and push you along.
It's really important to find those people. And those kind of people, you know, that have that instinct and they see somebody and they see something in you, and it's realistic, but that's how I wanted to be as a trainer. To be able to pick those little details out of people and go and just really nurture them.
Nurture the positive things.
And
grow on them.
Yeah, that's the kind of teaching and training I like. And I feel that's a really compassionate way. You know, our keyword is compassionate. And I think that kind of training, when you see what a rider's niche is and what their horse can do, because we've got this element of this other sentient being that's got a brain and a mind that, you know, doesn't always coordinate with our own. And so you have to be compassionate instantly for two separate beings that are trying to work together. And, you know, I've seen the effect on horses. Like if a trainer is just a really nasty, angry trainer, you'll watch those horses' ears go back and the tension in the body. And it's really, to me, it's just very palpable to see the detrimental effect a nasty trainer on a horse and a rider both.
Do you think there is still nasty trainers out there? Are you?
Oh.
Or do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, yes, because people bring, you know, in spite of like Equine Canada, is that, I mean, the program is so sophisticated now. The days that when I first turned professional, it was still kind of in its early days. And I believe Michael might have had something to do with the parameters of those early programs too, and perhaps, you know, so I was around the people that had a lot of influence on the certification program, the early programs. And so it's become such a sophisticated program. And because it's connected to Canadian coaching and, the ethics and the lesson programs. But that doesn't guarantee a compassionate person is going along with that certification. So they may get pass the certification program, but that doesn't change their baseline personality.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying, that they can, during their exam time, if they're an instructor taking their examination for their coaching certification, they can have their best face on for that day. But even though they have their best face on, the real true person kind of percolates through the day of their test.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you really know fundamentally what type of person that is, and they may not be the type of person that you want to. Oh, they may meet the criteria for the coaching, but they don't meet the compassionate portion of the criteria.
Right, and that's, you know, and that's, it's a different issue because, well, you know, from our perspective, compassion and mindfulness takes practice. And talking to Dr. Schoen, you probably got a lot of that from his interview about the, you know, the periods of quiet, focused intention prior to going into the barn. You know, applying mindfulness to the training program. And yes, it is there with the certification and the protocols and test days, and when you're under pressure of having to pass those exams, I think most people will absolutely have their game face on and be prepared, obviously, to put their issues aside for that day to pass and continue to pass the upgrades and et cetera. But when they're in the arena and they're under pressure in the moment, it may not guarantee that they can hold on to that. And that's what we're saying, is that mindfulness takes practice. It's continual practice. And especially coming from instructors, because instructors and coaches are mentors. And whether a student comes, you know, hauls in once a month for a lesson, or you see them four or five times a week, it's, you know, because the equestrian business is high pressure. If you have a big show barn, it's, you're going to be tested. Your patience is going to be tested, and, mm-hmm. you know...
And even on the other end of that spectrum, not a high-end show barn, but even a local freelance instructor or somebody who has a few horses at their own place, they are also tested at the limit of their patience as well.
Absolutely.
So how do you think the best way is to promote the compassionate equestrian? You have decided to do that via social networking.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of, you know, it's still uncharted territory for me, although I've been practicing for a few years, and being on an island kind of forces you to really think carefully about travel plans, because everything involves a ferry, first of all. I mean, there are horses here. To be able to keep compassionate equestrian in front of people, I'm not traveling. And I would have liked to have set up more of a center here, but I just couldn't do it within the atmosphere of this one particular barn. So initially I was going to do videos and broadcast from this particular facility, but I just couldn't get past those types of trainers. So that wasn't working. So I thought, okay, plan B, I will just stay on my computer. Although there's, you know, there's shows in Vancouver, there's Southlands, there's Thunderbird, Vancouver Island has some shows. But for me, the network is bigger than that. So yes, I'm social networking. It's still an experiment. It's a work in progress, because I'm just not sure how many people who are busy with their horses and going to all of these shows are connecting online. And that's, mm-hmm. it's kind of hard to tell. You know, I can see what our...
Particularly this time of year, right? When they're full swing of,
yeah.
of horse shows. And then I guess people head down to California or Florida and yeah. our neck of the woods.
Yes. And I've hung out at both those show circuits. You know, I've been at West Palm Beach, and I love it there. I mean, I love being at the big shows. You know, you see there's 2,500 horses on the grounds and 15 arenas going, and you see little bobbing heads and helmets everywhere you look. And it's a really fun atmosphere, and I kind of miss that. But you probably know, being a judge, that the hassle of traveling has become quite cumbersome. If I can do it, you know, without the travel, I would like to build that network and use videos, which seem to be quite helpful. But I would really like trainers and instructors to kind of, and coaches, to take up the book as a textbook. We're hoping to create the compassionate equestrian movement and encourage people to print the poster, the 25 principles of compassionate equitation, put it up in the barn, start a discussion group, which we actually have. There's Victory Land Dressage, Melissa Deal in the Carolinas, that has started a discussion group around the book, and they're doing some very interesting projects in conjunction with that. So it's really nice to see that these groups can break out with the book and kind of build a compassionate equestrian movement within their own demographic. So,
Susan, where can people get the book Compassionate Horsemanship?
Well, they can, the best place right now is probably Amazon. We're in Canada, so I assume we're speaking primarily to Canadians. So you would go to Amazon.ca. And if you're in the United States, you can get free shipping from the publisher, from Trafalgar Square Books, Horse and Rider Books. And all of that information is on our website, which is thecompassionateequestrian.com.
So thecompassionateequestrian.com.
Yes.
Okay, and that's the website that you're in charge of that?
Yes, correct. The Compassionate Equestrian is the name of the book.
Okay.
And the book is based on the 25 principles of compassionate equitation. And I'll tell you why I actually chose the word equitation instead of horsemanship. And that's because I think there's a lot of misconception right now in the industry around the word horsemanship. I mean, people say, I'm doing horsemanship. You know, it comes from a number of different sources. They're doing natural horsemanship. They're doing liberty work. They're doing a lot of things that, to me, have kind of left the foundations of classical equitation behind. And to me, because I was trained with classical traditional equitation, which actually does put the horse first, and it's training, as you know, the rider so that you allow the horse optimal movement, you don't interfere with his mouth and his balance, et cetera, et cetera. So I really wanted to instill the fact that we must have good equitation in order to be compassionate equestrians. And to me, it doesn't matter what kind of discipline or what breed or what tack you use. To me, equitation is still, good equitation is critical to how our horses feel and how they go.
How did you come up with your idea for the book, The Compassionate Equestrian?
Well, about the time I had gone to film school, and I really wanted to make a film about off-track thoroughbreds because that was the bulk of my career. I love thoroughbreds, and they kind of have disappeared, as you probably well know, from the hunter and jumper arena. Yes, and a lot of people, you know, really kind of have a problem riding the warmbloods. They've, you know, in North America, they've been breeding them lighter and trying to make a lighter horse, but there's a lot of soundness issues. I mean, there's a lot of soundness issues with the thoroughbred now too, but I still love the thoroughbred horse for jumping and eventing. Warmbloods seem to excel in dressage, but the handy little thoroughbreds are just wonderful. And of course, the issue of having them come off the track, or when they, if they're not really good at running, where do they go? And I won't get into the nasty details of where a lot of them end up, because I think most of us kind of know that, even though we don't want to talk about it. So I wanted to make a film about off-track thoroughbreds. And I was at film school, and my instructor, who's just hardcore documentary filmmaker, goes, well, you got to show the worst. You got to show the bad side. You've got to have conflict. I'm like, I don't want to have that much conflict. I just want to take this horse. And I found a case. I found this hunter jumper trainer at Southlands in Vancouver who had just pulled this beautiful gray 5-year-old off the track with a bowed tendon, and or an almost bow. And he had won his race, but he'd injured himself. So I had this lovely documentary going, and my instructor kept pushing me when he said, when he found out what happens to these horses and the amount of drugs that are used on the track, and he goes, you've got to put that in a film. And I said, well, I don't want to. But I did connect with this woman who had a horse rescue, and she was very, very helpful and very knowledgeable about, you know, really the dark side of the industry and what happens to these horses. And So I realized this documentary film would require a legal team with the size and clout of Michael Moore's movies, probably. So I shelved that and came to Salt Spring and was thinking about writing a book instead. And at the same time, Karen Armstrong's TED Talk started the that whole compassion movement and the Charter for Compassion. And everything just kind of came together. I had this really interesting circumstance. I was actually going to leave Salt Spring and not come back. I was going to go back to the mainland, but I had this little communication with a white horse and this woman who then told me to look up Dr. Schoen's book. So I did, and I immediately contacted Dr. Schoen. And when he came back to the island, he was away at his practice. And we started talking. We found out not only we're, you know, very different backgrounds, but having the same feelings about the industry. I had meditation practice for many, many years, as had he. And so it just seemed right to come up with principles based on the Charter for Compassion, and that's how the title and the book kind of developed.
So it sounds kind of like a very serendipitous way that happened, that you were going to leave the island,
yeah,
but then you hooked up with Dr. Schoen, so
absolutely,
who kind of fit together